Chapter 33. Hired Killers. I started killing people for pure pleasure when I was 8 years old. Then I learned that you could get good money for killing, and so I set myself up in business. The speaker was a 22-year-old Mexican, Josimo Montesino, whose murder record certainly exceeded 150. His first victim had been a witch who had bewitched his parents by giving them a strange brew. 12 years later, Josimo and his chief lieutenants, two brothers named Alcocer, set up an ambush outside the town of Tepalcingo. They had been hired by a local farmer to murder Mendoza Omana, a politician. Mendoza happened to be accompanied by his wife and 3-year-old son, but that made no difference. All three were cut down with shotguns, and the father and son killed outright, while the sobbing mother, lying beside the body of her boy, begged two peasants passing by to help her. "We can't interfere," they said, and walked off. Nearly 7 weeks later, the killers were arrested in a shantytown shack on the outskirts of Mexico City. They took their capture very lightly, treating it as something of a joke, and Josimo casually admitted to his 150 or so contract killings at prices ranging from between £3 to £150. A week later, he alleged that the confession had been obtained from him by torture. "I haven't really killed more than half a dozen people, and that was mostly in self-defence." Most of us find such casual brutality incomprehensible. It seems more frightening than the more familiar type of murder, the crime of passion or greed or anger. At least these have personal motives. To murder a stranger for money seems more depraved. Surely the existence of such monsters is a sign of some profound sickness in our civilization. Not necessarily. It's a mistake to try to judge Josimo Montesino in terms that would apply to the average citizen of London or New York. Mexico itself is a weird social paradox. It has the highest murder rate in the world. Murder actually accounts for more deaths than disease. Yet, up to a few years ago, it also had one of the lowest rates of juvenile delinquency in the world. In rural areas, the families were very close-knit. A Mexican teenager will put his arm around his mother in public without embarrassment. On the other hand, because there is so much poverty, life is cheap. It is only in affluent societies that people treat illness and death as a catastrophe. All poor societies have high murder rates. It's true of most tropical countries. And nowadays, as Mexico becomes more urbanised and prosperous, the rate of juvenile delinquency also climbs steadily. It's hardly surprising that Mexico seems to be caught in a spiral of crime. The theories of the anthropologist Ruth Benedict enable us to understand what is happening. Among American Indians, she observed societies in which there was a high level of kindness and cooperation. She called these high synergy societies. Other tribes were naturally mean and self-centred, and she called these low synergy societies. Mexico is in a process of transition from a high to a low synergy society. This does not mean that it will one day be wholly composed of mean and self-centred people. Civilization may cause a lot of problems, but it also produces a lot of people who care about their fellow human beings, so there is reason for optimism. Most societies start as high synergy societies when they're primitive, and then they drift towards low synergy as they become more sophisticated and civilized. As they slowly become more civilized, there is a movement back towards high synergy, and this appears to be a kind of social law. But when a civilization drifts from high to low synergy, it is the poor who feel the effects first. One cheerfully callous student of sociology compared the process to the rats that die first in a plague. This explains the existence of people like Josimo Montesino. It is clear from his confessions that he felt he was living in a wholly vicious and murderous society, where it was a case of kill or be killed. He told the police, "I don't know why you're making such a fuss about me. I know people who've killed more. For example, the police captain Cosme Maldonado. He was a real mass murderer." Josimo then described at some length how he and one of his gang finally shot Maldonado. It took 13 bullets to do it because he was so fat. Was Maldonado such a mass killer as Josimo represented him to be? Probably. In the Argentine capital, Buenos Aires, a few years ago, the police got so sick of the crime wave that a special execution squad was formed. They rounded up known gangsters, took them for a ride, and dumped their bullet-riddled bodies where they would attract attention and serve as a warning to other criminals. Typically, this rough justice squad got so out of hand that it had to be suppressed by the police themselves. The moral is a familiar one. In countries with a soaring crime rate and a high level of poverty, where the police are underpaid, they themselves are forced to outdo the criminals in brutality. So Josimo may not have been exaggerating when he called the Mexican police captain a worse killer than himself. But all this adds up to a low-synergy society, where two farm workers can watch a mother and child cut down by shotgun blasts and walk away saying, "It's nothing to do with us." If Josimo is by no means the rule among Mexican criminals, neither is he the exception. Martin Rivera Benitez, nicknamed Big Soul in the state of Hidalgo, told police in 1972, "I can't count the number of people I've killed for money. My fame spread so far that I often had a long waiting list. In order to prove that the job had been done properly, I would cut off the head and show it to the man who had hired me." In his mortuary in the woods near Xatatipan, 12 headless corpses were found. But these are probably only a small proportion of the people Benitez killed between 1969 and 1972. Police believe the victims total more than 50. "I didn't see anything wrong in killing for money," said Benitez. "If I hadn't done it, someone else would, and it was better paid than working as a farm labourer." The comment brings to mind the remark of Reggie Cray, the London gangster, to his biographer John Pearson, that in the society in which they were born, crime was the only way to get out of the social rut in which he was stuck. Another vital aspect of the psychology of the hired killer emerges in the case of Nestor Mancias Alejon, a 26-year-old youth who killed Isabel Garcia and her 9-year-old daughter Elvira with a machete. Alejon claimed that he was ordered to commit the murder by his employer, Señora Martínez Anguilla, who was jealous of a long-standing love affair between her husband and the victim. After paying a witch doctor £50, 1,000 pesos, to bewitch Isabel out of her involvement, the impatient Señora Anguilla ordered Alejon to kill her, or so Alejon alleged. Alejon was paid £55. "That's a lot of money for a man like me," he said. Señora Garcia's 9-year-old daughter was with her mother. The killer liked her because she was a nice, polite little girl. But as the child saw her mother hacked to death with a machete, she fought with Alejon and was also killed. The murderers, like so many others in Mexico, might have gone unpunished if, said Alejon, his employer had paid up. But Señora Anguilla lost her temper when Alejon admitted to killing the child, and she called him a sadist. She refused to pay, and Alejon made the mistake of going on the run, so that he became an automatic suspect. The police had been convinced that Isabel and her daughter had been killed in a rape attempt. As soon as Alejon was picked up, he confessed everything, implicating his employer. What's significant here is that Alejon claimed that he felt obliged to obey his employer's orders simply because she was his employer, his social superior. A psychologist who was asked to explain another contract killing of Olga Duncan by Luis Moya and Gus Baldonado, hired by Olga's jealous and vindictive mother-in-law, Mother Duncan, pointed out that the killers were Mexicans of poor family and that they found it easy to obey the orders of a white woman whom they felt to be their social superior. In other words, they felt absolved of the crime of murder in the way that the soldiers at My Lai felt absolved because they were ordered to massacre Vietnamese civilians by a superior officer. Soldiers in war generally feel no guilt about killing. Dispossessed persons of a socially inferior group often feel that they are at war with the non-synergic society that surrounds them. The Mother Duncan case also raises the interesting issue of the psychology of the person who hires the killer. Elizabeth Duncan had the typical criminal mentality, the outlook that can be seen in murderers like Neville Heath, Marcel Petiot, and George Smith, the Bride in the Bath killer. She was a plausible confidence trickster who could become so involved in her own lies that she came to believe them to be true. She was also an example of a rarer phenomenon, the female counterpart of A.E. van Vogt's right man, the man with such a paranoid obsession with being in the right that he will commit any violence rather than admit that he might be wrong. Mother Duncan was a right woman. When she set her mind on something, it seemed to her that it was one of the laws of nature that she should get it. A religious right man would say that it was the will of God. In her eyes, a woman who had married her son against her wishes had no right to be alive. It's tempting to declare that she was insane, and if the definition of insanity is to be out of touch with reality, then she was. But if she was insane, it was by her own will, her own decision. She wanted to believe that her wishes were the will of nature, and she had always lived in such a way that she had got away with it. The same may well be true of the principal figure in one of the most brutal cases of hired killing in America in recent years. The man behind the crime was a good-looking, smooth young lawyer named Joe Peel, who was a municipal judge at West Palm Beach, Florida. Peel was a go-getter whose ambition was to become governor. In 1949, at the age of 32, he seemed well on the way to achieving his ambition. He was well-liked, a member of the social set, and the owner of a number of thriving enterprises such as nightclubs. He also found vice profitable, but his neighbours knew nothing about this. It was in 1949 that Peel met an ex-convict named Floyd Holzapfel. Holzapfel was also good-looking and charming, and his criminal record was not too serious, a few incompetent gas station stick-ups for which he had served terms in jail. Holzapfel was weak rather than wicked, with a feeling that fate had always dealt him a losing hand and a strong desire to be liked and accepted. The chief obstacle to Peel's plans for political eminence was another judge, Curtis Chillingworth, who had had occasion to rebuke Peel for legal double-dealing. Peel had good reason to suspect that the judge had learned about his rackets and that he could not expect to remain a member of the Florida bench for much longer. To Peel's logical and ruthless mind, the answer was to murder Judge Chillingworth. When he explained the situation to his new right-hand man, Holzapfel was scared and also shocked. He was basically an easy-going, good-natured man, but his position as Peel's chief lieutenant also gave him the kind of standing and social respect that he had never had before. He allowed himself to be persuaded, but he stipulated that he needed an accomplice. Peel suggested a Negro called Bobby Lincoln, who was involved in his rackets. Lincoln was also a non-violent man with no criminal record, but when a judge asked him a favour, he felt bound to agree. On June the 14th, 1955, Holzapfel and Bobby Lincoln went in a boat to the beach below Judge Chillingworth's house. They expected him to be alone that night. His attractive wife was supposed to be with relatives. Unfortunately for Mrs. Chillingworth, she had changed her plans. The hired killers knocked on the door, and the unsuspecting judge opened it in his pyjamas. Holzapfel asked if there was anyone else in the house. The judge called his wife. Holzapfel and Lincoln tied their hands with tape and forced them into the boat. At one point, Mrs. Chillingworth screamed and was silenced with a heavy blow from the gun butt. Once at sea, they put weights around Mrs. Chillingworth's waist. Her husband said, "Remember, I love you," and she answered, "I love you too." And then they tossed her overboard. She sank immediately without screaming. At this point, the judge managed to fling himself overboard and began to swim with his feet. He was moving away from the boat when Holzapfel began battering him with a rifle butt. Then the anchor rope was looped around Chillingworth's neck and the anchor tossed overboard. The corpses were never recovered. But in killing a man as distinguished as Judge Chillingworth, Joe Peel had overreached himself. Police began an intensive investigation into his disappearance. It was a long job. And in the meantime, Holzapfel had a chance to commit another murder. This was of a crook named Lou Harvey, suspected of being an informer. Harvey was also forced into a boat, shot in the back of the head, and dumped in the canal with a block of concrete attached to his legs. A few days later, the body floated to the surface. On the night he was taken for a ride, Harvey had felt nervous and had given his wife the number of the car in which Holzapfel and Lincoln collected him. The police soon traced the car to Holzapfel. They now had a strong suspicion that this was how Judge Chillingworth had disappeared, and that Peel and Holzapfel were the men behind it. An acquaintance of Peel's, an insurance salesman named Jim Yenzer, was hired by the police to act as an undercover man. Yenzer's inside information had soon got Holzapfel into so much trouble that he was sent to trial for an attempt to hijack arms from a group of Cuban revolutionaries. He was finally set free, but his faith in Peel's friendship and his generosity had been heavily eroded. Holzapfel began to mutter threats. Peel now approached the police informer Jim Yenzer and offered him $2,000 to murder Holzapfel. Yenzer agreed, but kept putting it off. Since the police were now paying constant attention to Holzapfel's affairs, his boss persuaded him to flee to Rio de Janeiro, with a promise to support him indefinitely. Shortly thereafter, Yenzer also went to Rio de Janeiro, commissioned by Peel to murder the hired killer of Judge Chillingworth, and by the police to try to get a confession out of Holzapfel. He didn't succeed immediately, but he did succeed in persuading Holzapfel it was safe to return to Florida. And during a two-day drinking session in a motel in Melbourne, Florida, Yenzer and another undercover agent finally got Holsup Fell to describe the murder of the Chillingworths in detail, while other police agents listened in the next room with a tape recorder. It had taken 5 years of unremitting police work. As a result, Holsup Fell was sentenced to die, although sentence was not carried out, and Joe Peel and Bobby Lincoln each received life imprisonment. What emerges very clearly from the study of hired killers is that money is seldom the basic motive. In 1973, an American publisher brought out a book called Killer, the anonymous autobiography of a hitman who is identified on the title page only as Joey. According to Joey, he has 38 hits to his credit and rates as one of America's top hired killers. Born in the Bronx, Joey became involved in the rackets from childhood. At the age of 16, he was asked if he would kill a man. He accepted the job and shot the man in the back of the head in the street. "Then the realisation came to me that I was a made individual. I was a force to be reckoned with. A lot of people who'd looked at me as being some snot-nosed, wise-ass kid would now be speaking of me in different tones. The job paid $5,000. It's significant that he mentions the money last. What is more important is the feeling of being somebody. Joey's autobiography may or may not be authentic. An anonymous book is bound to be open to doubt. But there can be no doubt that these blood-chilling pages are an accurate reflection of the psychology of the hired killer. The money is only secondary, even in mob killings. All of which makes it clear that it is inaccurate to speak of hired killers. It would be more exact to speak of cat's paw killers. In the great majority of cases, the true psychological motivation is to be found in one man's dominance over another. The murders committed by the Charles Manson family are an archetypal example of cat's paw murders, and the Manson case also raises one of the basic legal problems of the cat's paw murder. Manson's defence, and the defence that his supporters have been making ever since, is that he did not order Tex Watson, Susan Atkins and the others to commit murder. They may have thought he did, but that does not make him guilty. In Manson's case, it's almost impossible to believe that he was not closely involved because his family committed at least 3 sets of murders, but in a more recent case, there is room for doubt. On the night of February the 19th, 1972, the home of Black Power leader Abdul Malik, also known as Michael X, burned down near Port of Spain in Trinidad. Police investigating what looked like a case of arson discovered the corpse of a man buried in the garden. It was Joseph Skerritt, a 25-year-old barber and disciple of Michael X. Further digging finally revealed the body of Gail Ann Benson, the pretty 27-year-old daughter of a British Member of Parliament. She had been stabbed 7 times and buried alive. Gail Benson, it soon transpired, had been the mistress of another of Michael X's close associates, Hakim Jamal. It was believed that she had disapproved of Michael X's influence over her lover and had tried to cause a rupture between the two men. This, said the police, was the motive for her murder. Skerritt was murdered because he happened to witness it. Jamal was also subsequently murdered by Black Power members in the USA. Michael X escaped to Guyana in South America, but was arrested there on March the 1st, 1972. In Trinidad, 3 lieutenants were arrested and accused of the actual murder. Of these, Edward Chaddy and Stanley Abbott were found guilty, whereas the third, Adolphus Parmasa, turned Queen's evidence and thus escaped conviction. It was his evidence that really convicted Michael X, who was sentenced to death as the man who gave the orders, although he claimed to have been at home at the time of the murders. And it must be admitted that on present evidence there is no clear proof that Michael X ordered the executions. He was hanged on the 16th of May 1975. His lawyers were given no time to appeal. The cat's paw killer is a social phenomenon, the product of a painfully evolving society. If Ruth Benedict is correct, world civilization will one day become a unified, high-synergy society. When that happens, the hired killer will be no more than a relic of our savage past.